Okay, so you can leave because I'm not going to tell you anything new. In this talk, what I'm planning to do is to map out some of the contexts of breastfeeding, especially in the public sphere. And what I'd like to do is make the case that breastfeeding is more than just a public policy or a public health issue, which is what it's often seen as or often characterized as. And that's where almost all the research on women breastfeeding and why women stop breastfeeding, which is the question I'm interested in, has so far taken place. So the research I'm planning on doing on this topic will explore breastfeeding within a wider social context in the contemporary West. And what I'm hoping to do is to use queer theory, feminist body politics, and a social justice rationale as frameworks for my investigation. So in looking in my talk at some of breastfeeding's many inherently contradictory, as I may characterize them, meanings and messages, especially when it's performed as an act in the public sphere, I hope to be able to start to tease out why women may not breastfeed and to talk about these reasons as reasons that they may not actually be able to acknowledge or describe. And of course, this is kind of a problematic assumption, so I want to talk a little bit about you with this. And I'm hoping in the question and answer period that you'll be able to give me some input as to where I can look for more hidden narratives in the lives of breastfeeding women. So I decided to call this talk Thinking About Breastfeeding or Driven to Dream. And for us five in the room who have breastfed, we know that thinking and breastfeeding are quite antithetical. There's a condition known as milk brain. That's a nice polite term for it, but especially in the early days and early weeks and months, you really are in a sort of fog if you're breastfeeding in general. To talk a little bit about myself, I am currently breastfeeding. I have an almost 2-year-old child named Clover, who I think many of you have met around the office. I also have a 9-year-old daughter who I have breastfed until she was 3. So I have about 5 years of breastfeeding experience, probably will have 6. I want to talk a little bit about my breastfeeding experience later as it's pertinent to the research. But the first thing I wanted to do to start off was to show you some images from a New Zealand breastfeeding promotion campaign that I ran across on the internet. So this is the first one. There are 7 of these in all. This campaign started in September 2009, and they all have a little line like this, a cute little line. And these posters are found in places like bus shelters, women's magazines, parenting magazines, and also there's at least one women's clothing store that has these ads displayed. They also have been doing some radio ads and some TV ads, and they've been, you'll see that there's a bit of ethnic diversity already, and you'll see more of that, and I've given you 2 other examples. But they've made sure to do those ads not just in English, but also in Maori and Samoan, which are 2 of the main language groups in New Zealand. So you'll see that in these ads, the women are all pictured breastfeeding in the public sphere. And this is the only ad where the woman is actually alone in all of them. All the other ones, she's surrounded by what I would characterize as supportive people, friends or family members. And also there's a larger circle of people around her that are either indifferent to or perhaps even actively quite cheerful about the fact that this woman's breastfeeding. If you look at the previous one, I think that's me back there, and you see that there's a kind of, the way this woman is placed, she can actually see this activity taking place. She can see the woman's breastfeeding. So it's not a secret, it's not hidden away, it's not something that you don't notice. The third ad takes place in an airport, and it's a little hard to find the website where these are actually, where you can actually download them, so I put it up there in case you would like to go and look at the rest of them yourself. But when I started looking at these ads, I thought that they were very powerful, and they really moved me quite a bit, and in fact, I was almost tearful sometimes when I looked at them. And now, once I had children, I was able to cry at toilet paper commercials. So I'm not saying this was any big deal. I wondered what in these would inspire this reaction. And I think that they are certainly compelling, but I think that the reason they're so compelling is that they're incredibly far from the reality as breastfeeding women experience it. And they depict this kind of idealized breastfeeding world, which I characterize as Hegel's das Sein und das Sollen, which is the kind we want, not the kind we have. So to illustrate the reality as opposed to the ideal breastfeeding, I would like to tell you just a little bit about my own recent breastfeeding experience. Because when I had my second child, I had pretty much worked out the kinks physically speaking. I was able to breastfeed successfully. And I actually found breastfeeding more difficult with my second child than with my first. And so this was, the reason that this was kind of odd was that I had a lot of the supports which in the literature they do say are contribute to a woman's successful breastfeeding experience. So for the first year of the baby's life, for example, I had a very supportive partner. I had, in fact, my whole family, the baby opens its mouth and everybody says, I think she needs a breastfeed, you know? So I breastfed her 5 minutes ago, but that's okay, they want me to breastfeed her again. So extra supportive. I'm in Vancouver, which is a relatively tolerant social context, but I did use that word tolerant specifically. You can link that to the other uses of the word tolerance. If you were to graph me on a continuum of women in terms of how much of the breast they're willing to expose in public, I have done the topless sort of low-grade activism of walking around on the beach or walking around on the seawall, and so I'm up there at the top of the graph. And of course, I was well-educated as to the benefits of breastfeeding, so why did I have this problem then? If you can keep that question in mind as I go through some of the aspects of the breastfeeding context, I think that will come close to answering it. First, however, I'd like to show you some statistics, and these are from a book that just came out in 2009 called The One Best Way, Breastfeeding History, Politics, and Policy in Canada. The authors are Tasnim Nathu and Alec Ostry. So this book showed statistics from 2003, and they were fairly comprehensive. And they showed that BC is the place where the most new mothers try breastfeeding of any province in the country. And that's 95% of women who start out giving it a try. Only 47% of women continue past 6 months, which is a drop of half. This is in the context of the World Health Organization's recommendation that women breastfeed for 2 years, and they breastfeed for the first 6 months exclusively. Now, I have to just put a little footnote to that, which is that recommendation is fairly new. So in fact, in 2003, it might have been a one-year recommendation rather than a two-year recommendation. Mm-hmm. And also, women aren't necessarily told that, because this is a recommendation that is in the context of developing countries where nutrition might be a little more of a chancy thing. So it might not necessarily be emphasized as much in a BC hospital or by BC midwife. There's another statistic that the only babies who are breastfed exclusively to 6 months, it's only about 17% of women who do that. Now, again, the asterisk on that is that a lot of babies at 5 months or 5.5 months will reach for a cracker and you'll give them that cracker. And so there you go, you're not exclusively breastfeeding. you didn't need your duty belt. You know, who's gonna do that? While there are a few caveats, the thing to note about them is that these are similar to statistics elsewhere in other Western countries, and that sort of follows the general trend. So who's most likely to breastfeed? In a nutshell, people like me, women who are well-educated, women who are white, and women who are relatively affluent. Who's least likely to breastfeed? Women who are poor, women who have less education, and moms of color are less likely to breastfeed than white women. So you can see that breastfeeding's benefits go to those who are already more socially advantaged, which is why I call it a social justice issue. Looking at the United States context, which is a little more grim than the Canadian one because healthcare is not funded to the same extent, women there, if they're poor, are less likely to have prenatal care. Prenatal care lack of prenatal care is associated with premature birth, which means that babies are born with lower birth weights. And generally, in that case, they tend to be slightly compromised in terms of their immune systems. We know that breast milk is, in some ways, it'll go towards ameliorating these issues, and it's helpful for babies that have a bit of a setback in terms of their start to life. We don't know, I mean, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a medical person, so it's a and even within the health community, there's not a consensus as to what degree of help there is, but there is consensus that it is helpful that women breastfeed. In the United States as well, it's a 6-week maternity leave is the standard, so you can see that's not a great amount of time to establish breastfeeding. Poorer women are more likely to have to go back to work rather than to stay for longer because they wouldn't have the support of, for example, another family who wouldn't be making enough money to support them not working. And for the U.S. context, a lot of the things that I talk about here come from Bernice Hausman's book *Mother's Milk: Breastfeeding Controversies in American Culture*, and that was published in 2003. So, also in Canada, while you do have this great one-year maternity leave, it's only funded at 55% of your pre-birth income, and there's quite a low ceiling on that. So, if a woman is, for example, a single mother, she often can't afford to take a maternity leave. And if she's self-employed, she can't take maternity leave generally because they don't fund it. So despite the fact that breastfeeding, as I see it, does have a social context, it's generally thought of exclusively and specifically in health terms. And I think this is true even in feminist circles and even today. So when I was proposing this project, I would be talking to people at UBC and say, you know, who do you think I should talk to? And they would say, oh, talk to midwifery, talk to nursing, even though this was a theoretical project. Breastfeeding, I don't think, is widely seen as a human rights issue or an issue of feminist body politics or an issue of queer theory. And I think that this is fairly understandable if you look at the history of feminism. I think that there is a real kind of 70s aspect to the idea that we have women who are more privileged telling women who are less privileged what to do, telling them that they have false consciousness. You know, we're going to help you understand that you should breastfeed rather than we're going to empower you in terms of your choices. You also have a lot of the assumptions of the feminist movement that have been questioned over the years, but one of the assumptions that does remain, that sort of bedrock assumption, is that it's our body and our rights, and that often goes at the heart of feminism for many people. So you really have a big clash if you're now going to say, oh, it's better that women breastfeed, even if they decide they don't want to. So perhaps because of these reasons, most of the research that's done on why women don't breastfeed is quantitative social science research that simply consists of asking them the question. So you'll get women will be given a questionnaire in hospital, they'll be sent one in the mail after discharge, they'll get interviewed by a health visitor, a midwife, or perhaps a lactation consultant. And they'll be asked, or they'll be given a list, what made you stop breastfeeding, they'll be asked. And the kind of answers that you get when you ask those sorts of questions in those sorts of ways are pretty similar. They're individual as opposed to more societal, and they concentrate on what I would characterize as socially unacceptable reason, or socially acceptable reasons, pardon me, for stopping breastfeeding. So the number one winner is not enough milk. Second, it was what I called laying the baby. The baby bit the mother, bad baby, or the baby weaned itself. And I have to say, I get told this, I mean, when you do research of this kind, or when you're talking about this sort of thing, you often get into anecdotal conversations with people. Even women who wean their babies around 1 year of age will often say the baby just weaned itself and lost interest. I was sitting there, come please, and the baby wasn't interested. You know, I have a very difficult time believing this because of how obsessed my own children have been and are with the breast, but they swear it's true. So the reasons are generally practical, but occasionally you will get what I would call a more quote-unquote selfish reason, where women will say they just didn't want to breastfeed. They'll say that they'll have an idea of sort of visceral disgust about breastfeeding. They'll say it makes them feel like an animal. The animal that's most commonly mentioned is, of course, a cow. And sometimes you'll get an explicit sexual linkage where women will say, I want my breasts to be sexual rather than a kind of mechanism for feeding babies. So even in these cases, though, what I'd like you to notice is that these are individual explanations rather than societal explanations, and they don't ever go into organizational reasons. So to give an example of this, another common reason that women cite is that they had to go back to work, but they don't say, I had to go back to work because the government only sees fit to have a 6-week maternity leave, or I had to go back to work, but my work doesn't have a place where I can pump in peace. Just as an aside, I have been also looking at some of the research on pumping, and in the US, because of the short maternity leave, pumping is a real focus of breastfeeding retention rates, trying to get women to pump once they go back to work in order that they can continue feeding their baby's breast milk. But some of the newer research that I have seen has said, you know, is it really about the magical substance of breast milk, or is it about the connection that you get between the mother and the baby several times a day? You get skin-on-skin contact, you get the smell, and you get the sound of the heartbeat, and so forth. So there's a little bit of a backlash against that whole pump emphasis right now. So when I look at these reasons, I start to wonder about what's unspoken. And I think there are a number of possibilities. First of all, I think it's unlikely that in the days and weeks after you have a baby that you're going to begin mounting a critique of Western culture's values, such as individualism, you know, that things that had probably worked well for you before, but once you have a baby start to seem like not such a great idea. And I think that, same thing, you wouldn't necessarily be looking at the social arrangements in your world and saying, wait a second, these are the problem, it's not me that's the problem, these are the problem. There's a second set of reasons that I think don't get mentioned, and I think these are reasons that really undermine the idea of the woman as the good mother, and I want to talk a little bit about breastfeeding's associations in order to explain this. Breastfeeding is one of the subjects that has really been depicted throughout the history of art. One of the areas that you'll see it a lot is in religious pictures. In Christianity, you'll see many pictures of the Virgin Mary breastfeeding the baby Jesus. If you've ever seen one of those pictures, you'll notice that the Virgin's breast always looks quite odd, sort of teacup shaped. And this isn't really because the medieval artists couldn't draw a naturalistic breast. It's actually was apparently done on purpose in order to keep people from having an inappropriate sexual response at the sight of a Madonna's breast. It was interesting. So as you'd expect, breastfeeding does carry a heavy load of meaning. I think it stands most of all for selflessness. I've been sort of a minor collector of breastfeeding stories over the years, and there's a story some years back where a boatload of Cubans set off for the shore of Miami, and something went wrong, the engine failed, they were thrifting, and there was one lactating woman on board that boat, and she kept everybody on the boat alive. I think there were maybe 11 or 12 people altogether. And this story, I think, really goes to the heart of how we conceptualize breastfeeding. It's a miracle substance, it's life-giving, it's just this amazing thing, and it's amazingly selfless. It's a kind of, there's a sense of mother love being inexhaustible, and the breast milk stands in so well for that, because you just keep going back to the tap, it keeps filling as you empty it. I was also looking up Sigmund Freud's comments on breastfeeding, and he had said that one of the first reproaches that children make against their mothers is that they didn't give them enough milk. And while he said that this is certainly, it could be a practical thing, it actually speaks as well to the kind of, the child always wants more than anybody, including the mother, can give. This is a bit of a symbol of that. So breastfeeding, I think, also suggests a melding of boundaries in an otherwise individualistic world, where the mother and baby, instead of being separate, are actually almost one. And breast milk, as well, is also seen as utterly pure. And this is kind of interesting, given that being at the top of the food chain, we ingest all the contaminants of all of the animals that we eat. So in fact, our breast milk is quite polluted, but you know, it's still better for you than formula, but it's not pure by any stretch of the imagination. But I think that if women want to smoke cigarettes or drink alcohol or take drugs, they then feel that they can't really do that in breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is also sexually taboo. So even though you have an exact or various the actions by the baby to stimulate the milk to come down are pretty much the same as you would get with another adult in a sexual situation, the woman is expected not to have the same reaction to it. And in fact, I don't know if anybody remembers, some years ago, there was a woman in the Maritime Provinces who was breastfeeding, phoned up the local authority and said, you know, I'm having a kind of sexual response to that, is that okay? And they said, wow, well, let us come and take your baby away from you. So that's what happened, and the La Leche League, you know, of course, got up in arms and said, that's perfectly normal, these people are freaking out over nothing. And so, you know, she did get the baby back, but that baby was gone for some time, and I think that really goes to the heart of how taboo any hint of sexuality and breastfeeding is. They just must never, ever, ever, in any sense, come together. I think that women may find breastfeeding because they may in fact stop breastfeeding because they find all these ideals impossible to live up to, but I think that this is something that remains pretty much unarticulated. So we come now to queer theory's contribution to this and where I plan to locate my research. I think that queer theory can really meaningfully interrogate the meanings inscribed on the female body by culture. I think that women know that the mother's body is a locus of scrutiny. I do get into a lot of anecdotal conversations with academics and researchers when I talk to them about this topic, and I remember when women say to me, ah yes, careful not looking at others in the public sphere. I think this is a really common experience as a breastfeeding woman. You see the averted head, the I'm not noticing what I know you're doing kind of head. It's amazing how much meaning you can get out of that. It's funny because I've seen more and more of what I'm calling modesty drapes, where women wear these sort of things over their fronts. They're kind of like a dentist's bib with a leg around the neck. But the weird thing is I'm seeing them not in spaces where you know, the woman is at the bus stop, like that woman in the second ad, but the last one I saw was at a attachment parenting discussion group where there were four or five families, you know, two dads, a lot of moms, a lot of other breastfeeding going on. This was not something that was going to necessarily horrify anybody, but so I'm interested in the level of self-policing that's going on when women breastfeed these days. It seems to be getting maybe worse rather than better. Now, queer theory quite rightly locates the female body by definition as a repository of sexual meaning, and this is especially true of women's breasts, and especially when they're exposed. And I think that this is context for a lot of arguments about women going topless that happened a number of years ago in Canada. So, if we look at the work of activists and queer theorists like Pat Califia, who's written about this in a book called Public Sex, we can look at the characteristics of where public sex takes place. And by public sex, I mean both mercantile sexual activity, like sex work, but also consensual sexual activity that's unpaid, like gay public sex. These kind of sex acts usually take place in places that are deserted, and they can be defined sort of as places where other people don't really want to be. And if they take place in a residential area, like for example Vancouver's West End, they're pushed out and pushed away. And I think our chair Becky Ross, along with Jamie Lee Hamilton, presented that scenario and described what happened there in the late 70s at a conference here at UBC in 2009. So these kind of acts will end up taking places in places like industrial zones and places like Stanley Park at night. And these places are quite dangerous for the people who are taking place in those acts, who are doing those acts just because they're deserted. And so if they run into any problems, there isn't really anyone around to help. You can also characterize public sex negatively by saying that it takes place not so much in daylight as at night, not so much in the public commercial sphere like malls, restaurants, and stores as in places that are relatively hidden away, or sometimes washrooms are an exception. And people who are taking part in public sex are really expected to hide themselves away because the contamination would be if other people actually ran across this sort of thing happening. So why am I bringing up all this about public sex? Well, when you start to look at public debates on breastfeeding, which there was another example last week, you'll start to see that there's a bit of a similarity between the way people talk about breastfeeding in public and the way that public sex is contextualized. So people will say, when there's an argument about whether a woman should be breastfeeding in public, the con side will say, well, it's inappropriate, the woman is putting on some sort of display, In the last week's example, if anyone saw it, the woman was breastfeeding a furniture store, and the owner of the store said, "Oh no, we're not anti-breastfeeding. You know, we've had plenty of women breastfeed in our store. All they do is come up and tell us they want to breastfeed. We show them to the break room, or we show them to the washroom, and you know, no problem, right? So as long as you're hidden away, as long as nobody sees you, it's okay that you breastfeed." So there's an inarticulate sense in these debates that the public sphere is an improper place for the act of breastfeeding. And I think that this reaction only makes sense if breastfeeding is read in terms of the paradox of being both public sex, which I put in quotes, and yet the ultimate maternal expression, which is a very desexualized kind of place to be. So it's a, it reminds me a little bit of St. Augustine's famous prayer, "Give me chastity, but not yet." It's give us this great maternal expression, not here. So, I think that this this dualism is really not just unarticulated, but perhaps impossible to articulate or even think. And it's this conundrum that leads me to characterize breastfeeding as queer in the sense that it disrupts heteronormativity. I have been looking at some work done by Fiona Giles at the University of Sydney on queer breastfeeding, queer adult breastfeeding, and that's not exactly what I'm doing, but she has brought up that idea of breastfeeding being queer. I'm more interested in how women's bodies, especially their sexual characteristics, are seen culturally as reserved for male pleasure. I think this is expressed in the West in the cultural fear that women have that breastfeeding will make their breasts unattractive. Mm-hmm. So more generally, the anxiety and tension of breastfeeding in public and going up against these unspoken contradictions remains unacknowledged and individualized. So if it's a problem, it becomes the individual woman's problem rather than a problem of society or cultural attitudes. So when we think back to the images from the New Zealand breastfeeding campaign, we can see that in the depictions there, that is not the case. The woman's in a larger context, she's part of the world, her breastfeeding becomes one of the appropriate activities in the public sphere that you would expect to run across. And interestingly, when I read up on the background for the campaign, one of the reasons they said they did that campaign was that most women thought breastfeeding in public was okay, but most women wouldn't do it themselves. That's kind of interesting. One of the other unacknowledged aspects of breastfeeding that I should mention here quite quickly, because I want to have time for conversation, is that it's a form of work and it's a form of specifically gendered labor. Now, I have run across a couple of articles about men breastfeeding, but these are more so-and-so said that so-and-so said kind of articles. There are never any actual examples that the researchers have seen themselves. So you'll see that the fact that this is very specifically gendered labor is acknowledged when you read the sorts of books that give you the pros and cons of breastfeeding and bottle feeding. And they'll say, well, gee, one of the cons of breastfeeding is the husband is going to feel left out. It's always a husband if the woman is the only one who can breastfeed her child. And there's also an unacknowledged loss of sleep for the mother in terms of doing that work, in terms of saying, oh, well, you know, let's lighten your load somewhere else. I was actually quite horrified to read in Mothering Magazine, which is not exactly the Bible of the attachment parenting movement, but more like the Bible commentary of the attachment parenting movement. They said, one of them, this article about how women should, breastfeed their babies and sleep with them at night. And they said one of the great things about this is that the baby has a chance for increased interaction with the mother. I don't know about you, but I'm not really very receptive to that increased interaction at 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 in the morning. In the West, there's no cultural tradition of feeding the mother so she can feed the baby that you do have in all other cultures. When my second daughter was born, I knew this woman who was Taiwanese, and she was quite distressed that I wasn't getting the chicken a day for the first 40 days. That's what you culturally should do in Taiwan. She was very serious about that. There's no tradition of bringing the woman food, although people may individually bring the mother food. I had Brazilian friends who very specifically timed their visits so that one doesn't need to give them anything to eat, left the entire cooked meal there for me. But that's not necessarily the Western way. So given these many conflicts, I was doing so well up till now. Given these many conflicts, most of them completely unacknowledged, I think it's really no wonder that women turn to the bottle. If you've ever breastfed a baby, the idea of bottle feeding seems a bit ridiculous because you have to get up in the middle of the night and heat it, and you have to carry it around with you, and it costs money, and like, why would you do that? But for the women who have a choice between breastfeeding or bottle feeding, who do choose the bottle, I think there have to be benefits that outweigh these drawbacks. And from what I can see, these include not just the practical benefits of being able to be away from the baby for, you know, a great number of hours at a time, but that the bottles don't have any sexual meaning or any sexual connotation. Mm-hmm. You can take out a bottle in any public space and it's perfectly okay. Nobody's going to care about it except me, because, you know, only big time lactists are going to be really upset that the baby's being fed formula. So I think that's got to be part of the reason when you look back at the statistics of the 95% start and 47% are still doing it at 6 months, why there are so many women who switch from the breast to the bottle. So in embarking on research on this topic, I find myself faced with a number of questions. And my work builds on some great work by other researchers, and I've cited just a few of them here. But I wonder where I'm going to find these narratives that will confirm my suspicions about why women are choosing not to breastfeed, given that part of my contention is that these are unarticulated or unacknowledged reasons. So maybe you have some thoughts about that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Breastfeeder, and who's done a lot of traveling by myself with children, I really appreciate it. And one thing that struck me about these ads that you showed, it is these images you showed, is that all the women were surrounded by supportive people, but by and large by other women, both sort of that bus in the airport, sort of the people sitting next to them are always other women. I'm wondering if that also ties in, I mean, with what you were saying about sort of the possible sexual connotations of breastfeeding having to be suppressed in order for women to feel comfortable doing it. Because if you had a man sitting there next to you, it would be very hard to do you want to depict him as sort of supportive, smiling, or do you want to depict him as like looking away? It would be awkward in any situation. I mean, and that's the situation that one often encounters, especially in an airport. Or, I mean, I've been in a situation where I was sitting in an airplane seat with two strange men sitting next to me, and you know, breastfeeding my baby so my baby wouldn't scream with the eye ears hurting. So I mean, these kinds of situations, I think, the situations that probably make most women most uncomfortable.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, I don't think men know how to handle them either. There's that great story about the woman who's topless on the beach and he's walking by, the male narrator's walking by, isn't going to look, but then he says, well, not to look would be to act like something's wrong, so I'm going to look, and, well, maybe I should look a little more, so I just show them, I'm like, pervert, and, you know, at the end of the story, he sort of gets up and hits him in the head. So yeah, like, what is a man supposed to do to respond appropriately to that situation? Yes?
I think one, like your last question, I think one of the main or potentially larger reason that a lot of women don't breastfeed, that is not talked about much, is that they're maybe survivors of sexual trauma. And I think that that's like a major deterrent, that if it's not addressed properly, sensitively, and thoroughly in like a prenatal care kind of situation, can be, you know, it can be re-traumatizing to sort of give like unlimited access to the breast, this demanding creature that's like accosting you in the night,
yeah.
All that stuff, and
yeah.
it can be deeply troubling to have these sort of the potentially like sexual feelings that
yes.
come up as a result
yes.
of breastfeeding.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I too really thought that as well, and when I talked to Bernice Hausman and brought that up and said, well, this must be the reason, because you know, even I was starting to feel like what, again? Oh, for crying out. You know, there really is a bad sex kind of connotation of breastfeeding. So I'm like, oh, fine, I'll just out this way, whatever, I'll just give it to you to shut you up kind of thing. And she has, I don't have the citation here, but I can send it to you. But in fact, she does know someone who's done some research on this. and apparently the opposite, has found that the opposite is true, that the breastfeeding allows you to re-territorialize your body that it was, you know, basically somebody else was using it against your wishes or not, and now you're able to say, no, this is something I'm doing, this is my body under my control, even though it would seem like, I agree with you, that it's very uncontrolled and you're not really in charge of it. So I don't know, I haven't looked at that research closely enough to know if it's a large kind of thing, but those are her findings so far.
I really enjoyed your talk, and it's good to meet you in person. I'm Sarah.
Sarah's breastfeeding twins.
Yeah, still going. I'm exhausted and sick right now, so let's see if I can make something articulate here. When you were bringing up some of the examples out of the U.S. and how there's a different class challenges involved in women sustaining breastfeeding relationships, I'm wondering if you know much about the WIC program. It's the Women, Infant, and Children's Public Health Program.
Oh, yeah.
It's across the U.S., and they hand out free vouchers for formula.
Yeah.
So that's another huge thing.
Yeah.
So if you're already disadvantaged, poor, have to go back to work, you know, buying yourself a breast pump or getting these free formula vouchers, one is a little easier to access than the other, and because they don't have a lot of time to, like public health people don't have a lot of time to sit down and counsel women and continue to encourage them to breastfeed, it can be easier from a public health person's perspective to turn to the formula vouchers. I have a whole bunch of other things that I wanted to chat with you about, but yeah, that's just one thing that came to mind.
Thank you. Let's we will come back after no one else has questions,
mm-hmm.
but you've had your head up for some time.
Just anecdotally, on your comment, I was on that island sitting next to a strange man, and I was nursing my son, and he asked me, he's like, does he have a favorite side? And it startled me so much that he was, you know, engaged in the program. And I really didn't know how to respond to that. So after your talk, I'm gonna go think more about that. but also a narrative that I've encountered, which seems opposite or counter to some of what you've presented here, is I have been told or suggested that by breastfeeding, I am being selfish. But I am selfishly, you know, maintaining this relationship between me and my child. And yes, and sort of self, you know, I'm that sort of self empowerment that I'm getting. That has been turned around on me, saying that you know, I am using this to be better or to be, you know, the ultimate woman.
So wait a second. So the reason you're being selfish is that you're showing up other women who are formula feeding, or is it that you're keeping your baby latched to you too long?
Not so much the first one, but definitely that I am forcing this relationship. You know, I'm using it
not letting your baby flourish.
Show that I am. Not necessarily to attendance, but just
keep
your baby.
It could be doing so much if you have to stubborn all the time.
Exactly, and that I am situating myself as, you know, a really, you know, good mother. I'm using that to show that I'm a good mother in a bad
way. Who would say that? I'm sorry, I don't want to put you on the spot, but like, have you heard this from more than one person?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's crazy.
Is an interesting.
I've never heard that. Thank you very much.
I've heard that in the context of co-sleeping and bed sharing.
Yeah.
Extended co-sleeping and bed sharing, or extended breastfeeding, I guess, in the same strain. So if you keep your child in bed, what kind of sense of individual are they going to have?
Yeah.
That would be.
Yeah, because
the
child has to be a full-blown individual at
the
age of one. Obviously, if not, there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. They're still bonded to you at that age.
I just wanted to problematize the context a little bit, because you talk about the West, and I think it's problematic to take the North America as the West, because you know, I come from Scandinavia. We have really different attitudes to our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Like my daughter, we moved here 2 years ago, and all of a sudden her consciousness about her body, for example, changed.
Mm-hmm.
She started to dress differently. Like we were in public in Iceland, and she could not handle it being naked in the swimming pool, which is what I grew up with, and everybody does,
mm-hmm.
because it's part of the school system. We just go, and we are all like from grade 6 to 10 or whatever.
Is it gender segregated?
No, it is.
So only girls are only boys.
But this is this consciousness of your body,
mm-hmm.
and like breastfeeding in public, I think is pretty common.
Did you have experience, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but did you have experience of breastfeeding both in Iceland and in Canada?
Oh, no. But in Holland. I was in Holland.
Okay.
And but I think that would be...
And did you find it, I mean...
No, that was pretty similar. Like, Holland is, you can do that probably.
And was there ever any issue about... Did you ever have a moment silence about breastfeeding?
I think it's maybe I'm idealizing it as well,
right.
But you know, but I think like talking about the U.S. that's
mm-hmm.
for me is
mm-hmm.
like very extreme.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of attitudes towards birth, like
yeah.
in Iceland, you just don't choose a doctor or a midwife; you just get a midwife.
Yeah.
We don't even talk about that unless there's something wrong with you. And I never saw a doctor just once, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very different context.
Yeah, you certainly can't generalize, and I don't want to imply
yeah.
that you know. It's the same. I mean, the U.S. I think is kind of horrific extreme, but
yeah.
sometimes it's useful. I'll
yeah, it is,
like.
But just to kind of, you know, West is
mm-hmm. Thank you. Sarah, did you answer?
No.
Sarah, did you want to talk a little bit more?
Well, I suppose, like personal anecdote, I was thinking a lot of my own breastfeeding experience
mm-hmm.
While you were going through your talk, and I observed the same thing about these images that there are no men accompanying the women in these public situations, and it made me think of how my husband and his friends who have breastfeeding partners have gone through an interesting personal transformation, being a breastfeeding dad or a dad support but breastfeeding. He, like, because I'm nursing twins, I'll often do it in public. He will be right there with me and hold a baby in place to assist me, and he becomes part of the breastfeeding practice. And you spoke about men turning their eyes away, or other people turning their eyes away when they see a woman breastfeeding in public. And although the guys do that, they will, you know, say to a new mom and a group of friends, can we give you a chair? Can we set you up? Often as your family and friends seem to do. I just think it's interesting that those dads aren't in public in any way. I see that in people's homes, and I see my husband would be in public helping me breastfeed, but I don't see it in these images, don't see it in television, don't see it in other media
yeah.
observations.
Yeah, and I think one of this image is one of the most poignant for me, just because she is alone, and I think I read breastfeeding as being a very vulnerable state, and I'm almost worried about this woman
mm-hmm.
being alone breastfeeding by herself, you know. And the other thing I always hate about breastfeeding images that are produced is they almost never have, this one is the worst offender, but they never have the support for you need the support under the arm that's holding the baby, and if you spend like even a single session without that, as she is, you just become, you know, it's quite excruciating. See, these women are okay, but so they're not
so super happy. They're just like,
whoa, it's so great.
And they're very clothed.
Yeah, very clothed.
Yeah. When I'm breastfeeding, I'm hot. I would not be wearing a jacket, and you'd see the top of my breasts.
That's true, and yeah, that's the other thing I noticed. They did put out a couple more, and I noticed that there was more of the flesh visible. But yeah, in these earlier ones, there's absolutely no
like
flesh visible.
Especially.
And yeah, I'm just like, wow, how do they do it? Okay, whatever.
Becky,
you
have
to
pull off.
I was just going to say something about the rugby legend. I mean, that's clearly not an accident. I mean, that,
right.
For me, I that shouldn't go uncommented upon. I mean, that for me, that's about, I mean, I don't know that there's any image of manliness that is ascribed so much virility and machismo than a rugby player, let alone
yeah.
a rugby legend. there's something there that's clearly masculinist and sexist, but also heterosexist, and this fear that somehow young boys particularly stay breastfeeding until age three, that's going to sissify them or feminize them or emasculate them in some way, and instead this is a kind of interesting recuperation.
Yes,
in spite of this breastfeeding, the boy is still likely to emerge as this sort of fully formed, heroic, lionized figure in the sporting world, and in Australian or New Zealand context, rugby is a big deal.
Yeah, well, they also have, I think they have a computer, they have one that's like a future computer whiz, and so yeah, they're not all completely masculine occupations,
yeah.
but yeah, there's definitely, I think,
theme. The other one was, I think,
astronaut.
You don't usually think male, not female.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then
the other
one's
travel writer.
Travel writer.
Mm-hmm.
although the infants do seem to be either gender non-specific or voice in these images.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they do seem to have the same.
It's hard to know with the ones that actually breastfeeding
males. Yeah, you can't tell.
You can't tell, but it does read a little bit more boyish just because of the color.
There's
no female specific colors.
Or
yeah.
They do. Yeah, they do seem very engendered or masculine male. I like this one best for some reason. It seems to me like that older woman might be related to her. Just the approval.
I wanted to maybe comment on something that also I found a very interesting observation that you made about these covers and in general, so these spaces that are supposed to be supportive of breastfeeding, but all these technologies, and that's maybe something that's, you know, thinking about sort of international comparisons. I had both my children in Canada, but I'm from Germany originally, and also traveled to Russia with them, so I've since to Russia, Germany, Canada. And in neither in Germany nor in Russia have I seen as many of sort of these props that are supposed to help you breastfeed.
Yeah.
So there I had more the feeling that you get less, you're more on your own if you do it, but also you don't feel under that pressure to actually sort of accept all these.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there's no lactation womb that you could withdraw to if you chose to. So I mean, if it's not necessary then that people, that women there, that you see more women breastfeed in public, but if you do see it, or if you do it yourself, you don't feel that, you know, there are these alternatives that you're sort of rejecting and you're deliberately destroying other people's peace of mind.
Yes.
And to me it does feel like kind of a hyper desexualization that you, I mean, here in North America it almost feels like that act will be so automatically associated with sex by other people that you have to sort of go to all these lengths to to kind of neutralize it, and that feeling I don't get in Europe as much.
That's interesting.
That's my own anecdotal.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's really a good point. I mean, I had a friend who tried breastfeeding, couldn't do it, and so she was in Germany, and she said she just had the hardest time finding formula in Germany, and it's sort of sold like a dirty little secret under the counter, and, you know, it's not on display anywhere. I often find myself quite conflicted about things like breastfeeding rooms, because on the one hand, if a woman doesn't want to breastfeed in public, she shouldn't have to, but on the other hand, I don't want the room to be there as an implicit kind of, you know what, you should just take this sick act out of here and put it somewhere where people don't have to look at it. So I feel like, yeah, there should be the rooms, but no, there shouldn't be the rooms, and I don't really know what the answer is. I guess it's like dedicated bicycle lanes. Julie?
I'm really interested in the connection between work, paid work, and ability to breastfeed and to continue breastfeeding, and thinking about some of the comments that Bjork was making about context. I mean, if you think about the American context in particular, but Canada's not a lot better, maternity leave is truly appalling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most Americans have no maternity leave whatsoever, no paid leave.
Yes.
They have unpaid leave for like 6 weeks. That's not maternity leave.
That's
if you, so I'm wondering, like, how much does that connect to the very attitudes around breastfeeding, given that the public observation of breastfeeding may happen less often here if women are not breastfeeding as often because they quit so soon because they can't afford to, etc. So I'm just wondering if anybody's done research that actually looks at, you know, women's integration into the labor market and the supports around that, not just maternity leave, that's a big one, but also, you know, adequate childcare, all of those kinds of issues, as well as the gendered pay gap, you know, because I mean, I would put those things together. So
yes.
I would expect that the Netherlands would be great. I would expect that the Nordic countries would be really good. Germany's a bit of an outlier because their policies on gender are pretty crappy, but women are not as integrated into the labor market at all, particularly professional women. France, I would expect to be great.
Well, France.
So I would think about, you know, like thinking that too, and how that then plays into these kind of cultural representations. How those things.
Well, yeah, I think class is incredibly important, and economic realities are incredibly important, almost deterministic in terms of what women do and don't do around breastfeeding. But I think that a lot of the research, in, at least in the American context, has really focused on the pump. Yeah, there's a pump there, there's a pump badge. Should there be a pump in the room?
So we can't change anything else.
This is exactly what the American context is, to try and, okay, the woman needs to go back to work, the woman needs to be separated from her baby, so how can we make this work, and the woman needs to breastfeed, so how can we make this work? We'll get a piece of technology that will facilitate this. We won't challenge this
horrible ecosystem,
horrible setup. Yeah. I commend you for going out in public with your twins. I think that the other woman I know, I don't think she's left her apartment for 6 months.
I am so highly motivated. I don't know many other lots of twins who are breastfeeding as long as I have with my boys. But I also know that the lack of support that they've encountered has been overwhelming in terms of just, you know, you've got a lot of challenges with you maybe having a cesarean section for your twins. You know, they come prematurely more often, so they're in the hospital longer, and it's tough.
Well, even logistically,
kind of like your experience, right? You have everything in place, all those advantages.
Well, even even logistically, it takes twice as long sometimes to feed them. So you know, so by the time you finish one feed, and they're quite small, you're ready and cleaned up, and maybe shake over and get some meat, and then like now we're ready for the next one. You haven't made it to the door, much less outside. Sorry, I saw another hand. Hi.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about this idea of what it means to be a good mother, and how these types of campaigns, while they may empower women to breastfeed in public, what about the women who can't, who have given birth and are having trouble lactating or whatever obstacles they have and they can't? What does it do for them? And especially, I've noticed that with formula ads, it'll always say, you know, at the bottom, like, breast milk is best. But this is your alternative if you can't achieve that.
Yeah.
You know, undertone you failure. You know, like that's how you know. And I'm just wondering, sort of the backlash of.
And I think a huge amount of all the research and all of the emphasis has been on, if I want to characterize this, say 90% of the approach has been, let's not make women who don't breastfeed feel bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, everything has been couched in a way, and to get these very aggressive pro-breastfeeding campaigns only in the last little while, and I'm painting it with a broad brush, but that has been the absolute main concern of people in terms of breastfeeding when they try and figure out ways to promote breastfeeding has been, number one, let's not make women who don't breastfeed feel bad. And I don't know if that's the, you know, I mean, would women breastfeed more if there was more peer pressure? Would that be a good thing, a bad thing? You know, are women empowered to make their own best decisions when they've, you know, just given birth or in a context where it's not supported? I don't know. I struggle with those questions myself. That's a very good point. Leslie?
Yeah, Carillon, I thought about the context of this ad campaign. I was just in New Zealand, and I see this in the context of public health. There is an acknowledged crisis, nutrition crisis,
mm-hmm.
among Pacific Islanders.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the public health campaigns, anti-drug, you know, sort of family support, nutrition, which is what I see this as,
mm-hmm.
are in Melanesian and Polynesian languages.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and there's a huge education force down there right now, including research and, you know, ads everywhere, billboards. Rugby is a significant player in a lot of those billboards. Especially anti-drug campaigns. So yeah, I think there's, you know, I see something else also going on here, sort of a move towards, you know, a development kind of discourse around, you know, the breast milk is good, this is the way women should be going. There's a lot of press right now about obesity and absolute reliance in the Pacific Island nations, among the Pacific Island nations, on aid food, you know,
mm-hmm.
tins of mutton
mm-hmm.
They're trying to get rid of. People aren't growing their own foods
mm-hmm.
in these places that are relatively fertile and where they have access to garden areas, you know. And it's very much a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that might be another layer to that as well.
Yeah.
That might work here, but.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, yeah. it's complex.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
not something that I think you can necessarily give a simple answer to, but it definitely has that. I think it's almost a perfect storm. It brings together a lot of stuff about femininity and motherhood, and yes, a lot of cultural issues specifically. Interestingly, when in days past, in years past, breastfeeding was more likely to happen among women
mm-hmm.
who were less women who lived a more traditional lifestyle and more close to the land kind of lifestyle. So. But then of course, like the Italians in New York City in the 1930s, where they said, don't have this filthy Mediterranean diet. Tomatoes are not good for you. You know, eat this good white bread. And so then you get an embrace of that kind of thing with gusto. And so then it moves quite a bit in the other direction. But in fact, for a certain period, when I said that the type of women who breastfeed are women more like me, that hasn't actually always been the case. It's often been the case that women who had less resources, especially, of course, women wouldn't be access to formula.
You'd have a wet nurse.
That's right.
Yeah.
I would have a wet nurse or I would be quite ostentatious. There's an 18th century cartoon of this woman breastfeeding this aristocratic English woman. She's holding the baby up like this, those sort of dresses that they wore that put the bosom on display. She's got the baby breastfeeding, and she's sort of serving tea, and it's this, like you said, it's this ostentatious, I am a better mother because I don't send my baby up to a wet nurse like all my fellow upper class white women, So that would have been one way or the other. If you had the privilege, you would have either sent your baby to a wet nurse as a matter of course, which even then was frowned upon, and there were a lot of, there's always, the interesting thing is there's always throughout history been a discourse of why don't women breastfeed more? And, it often has been the case that why don't the richest or the most upper class women breastfeed more, because they are the ones who have the option to send children out to wet nurses, which at an incredible mortality rate. But I think we're after 1 o'clock, so I'm not going to get into that.
I see one more hand. Yeah.
There's also the medical professions that for a long time been invested in kind of imposing
mm-hmm.
schedules on breastfeeding.
Even today, you'll have a sort of when you're breastfeeding, you say, "I'm not going to breastfeed every 15 minutes," and then of course later on you find out baby was getting sick or something, so you need to breastfeed all the time in order to build up your supply. Yeah, we still think we know better than babies. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it.